Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra is poised for another concert in the 2016-17 season. And here to talk about it is Ward Stair, the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra music director, and soprano Nicole Cabell. Welcome to each of you into our studios. So nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
Nice to see you as always.
This is an interesting evening with kind of a bookend, a thematic bookend that you've put together. The first half of that bookend, Ward, is a composer who I don't think has ever been represented with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, and that's Elliot Goldenthal. And you're doing a waltz and agitato from Pravda. So tell us about that.
Well, it's the way it came about. I actually worked with Elliot 2 years ago, I guess. Yeah, almost exactly 2 years ago now. With the other orchestra that I conduct down in Georgia, and he wrote a piece for us called the Lyric Suite, which I liked a lot, and we premiered it in New York City at Le Poisson Rouge, and I loved working with Elliot, and he's a great composer. Of course, he's a very famous film composer, so even if you don't recognize his name in the concert hall, I bet you've heard his music. He won an Oscar for his score to Frida, and if you look him up online, he's got a very impressive resume. All the film scores that he's written, and his music is extremely descriptive. It's really, I think it's wonderful. It's well crafted, and so when I was putting together this thematic, the American Music Festival sort of element throughout the entire season, I wanted to find pieces by American composers to include, beyond just our festival that was in the fall, and so I called Elliot and I just explained. I said, I know you have a lot of music that really needs to be performed that, isn't for film. And I described let him know some of the programs that I, still had a space for. And I told him I was going to do Shostakovich 5. And he said, I have the perfect thing. I said, really? Tell me about it. And he said, well, it sort of depicts 2 days in the life of a Soviet worker. And that was actually his working title. That was what it was previously called. And I said, oh, really? Tell me more about it. And he said, well, it sort of contrasts the the heavy industrial kind of mechanical, robotic feeling of, that era, the Soviet era, with, the more romantic troubadour kind of element. And those two things are juxtaposed. And he uses a waltz, but it's a very sort of gruff, rough waltz, kind of like the second movement of the Shostakovich. And so I thought, this sounds wonderful. Send me the score. I can't wait to see it. He sent me the score. I looked at it, and I just thought it was perfect. So I'm thrilled to include it, and it'll be the world premiere for this concert piece that he's crafted for us. So I'm really thrilled about it.
What will we expect to hear when you play Pravda?
Well, there's a lot of, it's very aggressive. There's very over the top in the language that he uses. I mean, there's an anvil in the percussion section. There's whooping and, walloping in the horns. There's a lot of really driving, repeated notes. Goldenthal studied, he was a protege of Copland's, actually, for a while, but he also, he's got some minimalist elements in. So some passages may sound a little bit like John Adams, in terms of the repetition of themes and the insistence with which they're used to drive the whole orchestra forward. And it works perfectly with the concept of, being in a factory working and then trying to sing and sort of enjoy yourself while you're doing it. So it's very boisterous. It's very extroverted. And you'll hear a huge, huge range. I mean, the orchestra is just like, in HD color with all these amazing sounds and techniques that he uses. And it's only about 6-7 minutes long.
And then in stark contrast to that, right after that, in comes Nicole Cabell to sing Ravel's Scheherazade, a beautiful piece of music, very introspective. Ravel set this music to the cadence of poetry of a friend of his, Tristan Klingsor. So the music meets the words very well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a piece that you sing fairly regularly. How does it speak to you when you sing it? What does it say to you, Nicole?
Well, I'm a sucker for French music, and I'm a sucker for Ravel. I've always been drawn to music of this period, and particularly French composers. So for me, it was just a matter of time when I first heard it at the Eastman School of Music. I was researching a lot of different compositions at the time, things that I wasn't ready to sing quite yet. But when I first heard it, I thought, okay, it's a matter of time before I get to sing this music. And it really, just as a, from a singer's point of view, it's like butter. It really is. on the chords, it is just, it's written so smooth, and it's written with these beautiful lines. There's not a lot of vocal pyrotechnics. It's really all about beautiful line poetry and expression of text. So for me, those are all the things that I like to concentrate on when I sing. So it just really suited me like a glove. And, you know, it's hard to say what does it, it speaks to me musically a little bit more than poetically, only because the poetry is a little bit archaic. I mean, of course, it's an idea of what Oriental culture would have been like at that time. It's just I haven't been here, but this is what I hear it's like. And so it's a Western interpretation of something, an experience that this the first piece, Azi, specifically, that the singer is supposed to not have actually had, and it's an idea of what it could be like. And so you have to have a sort of childlike approach and enthusiasm with the kind of sneaky sensuality and maturity of an adult that is manipulating the listener of this poetry. So you have to be kind of clever in how you approach it, this first piece. The second and the third pieces, those are written really more from the perspective of somebody who is there and experiencing this. So it's a little bit more introspective and personal. And it's really a very subtle contrast between the pieces in terms of music. So the color can seem almost similar for all three of these pieces, which I think is about 20 minutes of a similar color with a few sparks of excitement in Azi, where the singer, in my case the narrator, is basically talking about the excitement and the violence that might be happening around them in the midst of the really prevailing overtone of sensuality. So yeah, so me as a singer, of course I love singing it, and as a poet, it doesn't have a kind of personal connection, but rather an opportunity to express as a vocal actress this poetry.
I know that you are very fond of Ravel's orchestrations and the colors that he brings. This one, I think, is particularly colorful. How does Ravel work the orchestra around these words? Because it all is based on the words.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because when he was a member of this group in France that, you know, in Paris, that they would, you know, come together and sort of exchange ideas, and that's how he met Klingsor. That's only his pen name, of course, you know, but it's very Wagnerian, Tristan Klingsor.
I think Arthur Leclerc was his name.
Arthur Leclerc, exactly. But he, I think Leclerc or Klingsor, recited several poems one night, and Ravel approached him, you know, and said, I'd love to set these three. And he, I read somewhere recently that Leclerc was surprised that Ravel wanted to set Azi, because it actually has—it's a lot of text, believe it or not.
Yes, it is.
But it's wonderfully descriptive, and Ravel, I think this is probably the pinnacle in all of his vocal work of his text painting and the mastery that he had with it, because he, first of all, that he could hear this poem and then immediately his imagination was set afire with it is interesting and not surprising when you consider what a brilliant orchestrator and colorist Ravel was. But, I mean, he takes... there's so many soft dynamics and so many variations between, you know, the piano and pianissimo that we have to do in the orchestra. And there are a lot of very subtle shapes, very subtle crescendi, diminuendi, but they all have to be taken in context. So it requires a tremendous sensitivity in the orchestra. And he'll, you know, in Azi, when he's talking the the poem talks about, you know, as Nicole said, this fantasy of what it's like. He puts in all these little elements. It's almost like opening tiny music boxes one at a time with these snapshots of what life is supposedly like over, you know, in the Far East. And so you'll hear beautiful use of the harps. There are two harps in this piece, and they have, you know, independent lines. Sometimes they're together. There's a celeste, the use of the glockenspiel, the use of the strings in terms of, you know, how they're textured, all the different things they have to do from one movement to the other, whether it's tremolo or sul tasto, where they play way over the fingerboard so you get this deliciously muted color, harmonics, the way those are used. I mean, it's just it's a real feast for the ear in terms of just the orchestration. And then when you look at how it interacts with the text, it's just, I mean, it's astounding how beautiful it is. And it's all so subtle, and it's so... It's really delicate.
There's a lot of chiming, ringing type sounds that go through this, very, very gentle. Some conductors, music directors, have said they find it more difficult to work an entire orchestra through this very small, gentle sound than it would be for a big crescendo.
Oh, there's no question. Subtlety is always the most difficult thing to achieve in music, and a real beauty and an intensity at the very softest dynamics. It's anyone can play loud. Loud is easy. It's soft that's hard, because it requires much more discipline. It requires much more control, you know, from us, and I think from the vocalist too, because to make the long lines that you'll hear Nicole sing, I mean, it really requires a tremendous amount of control, breath control, control of the text, command of the big picture. And if you listen carefully to the score, he'll Ravel, another thing that he does so brilliantly is he puts all this detail. It's great, you know, everything in miniature within the frame of a larger phrase. So, you know, for us in the orchestra, I'll be giving larger gestures, but they have to fit everything in perfectly. You have to have subtlety and delicacy, but also precision. Is very important, and so it's really great for us to be able to work on this, and to do it with someone like Nicole is really a luxury, I have to say.
Ravel knew about Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade.
Oh, yeah.
Do you find any relationship between these two interpretations of that storyline?
It's difficult to make any direct comparisons other than with the name itself. I mean, the thought of the fantasy and telling the stories, of course, is a direct connection. But then musically, not as much, although, you know, Rimsky-Korsakov was a great pioneer in terms of orchestration and coloring of the orchestra. And so Ravel certainly took a cue from that and took it to the next level, and maybe the next three levels.
Nicole, you talk about the expression of the text and these beautiful long lines. And I was listening to Scheherazade just today, and there was this moment where I thought, this somehow, not thematically, but certainly in my heart, feels so similar to the four last songs. It has that quiet drama to it. How do you bring, and I know you sing the Strauss.
I do.
So how do you bring that quiet intensity to a piece like the four last songs or like Scheherazade?
There's a whimsy to Scheherazade that isn't that sort of that lends itself to that introspection, and I think introspection is entirely what Four Last Songs is about. It's very personal, and Four Last Songs tends to, in my opinion, it tends to be three or four levels deeper in the human psyche. It addresses things that everybody eventually will experience or have experienced. This is death we're talking about. And you can almost say that Scheherazade is all about life, about experiencing all the things that are there waiting that I haven't experienced yet. Or even in the third song we're talking about of Scheherazade, the presence of something unusual, another person, a new experience to have, and the freshness of that. So in that sort of push and pull between the two, one being on one end of the spectrum and the other being on another end of the spectrum, in a way there is a similarity in that, if that makes sense. It's neither one is excessively dramatic, and I think that's what you're getting at, which is even in the pursuit of life and the deliciousness of life that Scheherazade has, it is very subtle, and it is very sensual, and it is very personal in that way. These are the things that I want to experience, right, as the narrator. And I find that singing Four Last Songs is one of those things where at the end of singing Four Last Songs, I always am fighting back tears, but I have a smile on my face. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And the Scheherazade is, I have a smile on my face too, but I'm almost fighting back laughter. So it is that it's a dance between the two. And you're right; they're both very beautiful music and not bombastic and very trance-like.
You said you found this at the Eastman School of Music. When were you there?
A long time ago.
So I know that you went on to Juilliard, and from Juilliard almost immediately to the Lyric in Chicago with no stop at all.
Yes.
Clearly, you went to the Lyric very quickly as well. So the Lyric, obviously, Ward has a very good taste. they managed to find talent really young, apparently. What did the Eastman give you when you walked out of the Eastman with your degree in hand? Mm-hmm. What else did you have?
Well, there's so much really I can say about Eastman, and I would definitely not be here without my education at Eastman. And I might be one of the lucky ones, but I kind of think that without exception, people will say what I'm saying, which is the community is incredible at Eastman. And I am very much in regular contact with people that I went to school with or that went to school in other years that have contacted me and say, oh, we are peers because we have this very strong community. It's a school unlike others. I have not seen that very much. I've seen that at Juilliard. You sometimes have that kind of community. But Eastman, if you're an Eastmanite, you're part of the family. If you're an Eastman alum, they offered a very extensive, tough academic education, but also I was lucky to have performing experience. And I came there a little later I was a little bit older, I should say. So I was able to take advantage of performing maybe more than some of my peers. So I really got a very full and complete education for an undergrad.
What were you doing between graduating from high school and saying hello to Eastman?
Finding sanity. I think when you leave high school or you leave an undergrad program, I don't know if a lot of people have the luxury to do this, but taking a little time off to find yourself is important because, you know, having to find yourself in the midst of the pressure of going to school or starting a career, you know, we have that unique luxury in America and maybe in other first world countries of just having that ability to take some time. And I did. I took a little time off and had another job, and that's when I realized I definitely wanted to sing. Working at a cubicle, I said, yeah, I think I want to be an artist. So, and also getting some other credits at a local college, you know, taking some time.
And you are now still attached to the Eastman in a way because yes. You work with Benton Hess at Si Parla Si Canta.
Yes, I'm very lucky to be able to be one of the educators at this great summer program in Urbana, Italy. This will be my fourth year, and it is a wonderful program for singers of all levels, really, as long as you want to sing classical music and you've put in some footwork. It's one of the programs I have to say, and I don't think I'm being prejudiced here, but I think it's one of the best, and I think that's partially because it's a very intense language program as well as a performing program, so very pleased to be part of that.
So the idea is to land in Urbana and learn how to sing Italian.
How to speak and sing. You know, I'm still working on that. That's one of those things where I took a year off before I went to school, but if I had taken a year off after undergrad, I would have gone directly to Italy, maybe to France, someplace to intensely learn the language, because I travel all over the world. I know how to get to a bathroom and order in a restaurant, but my brain is a little older now, and so it's just hard to, for those words to sink in, and I would do that at a much younger age if I was to go back in time.
And just going back in time one more time for you, that's to ask you about winning the Cardiff Singer of the World. Now, that's pretty huge.
I count myself very lucky. Luck is preparation and timing, isn't it? So I know that I put in the work. I say I'm lucky, and they say, no, you're not lucky. You worked hard for it. I say, well, everybody at that competition worked hard for it. I just happen to have a good day and have judges that appreciated what I had to offer. So I look back at it and say, I am very lucky and I'm very grateful for that opportunity. It was incredible. We had a live performance in front of millions of people in the UK. And the UK is still very much kind of an extra or an additional musical family. It's a musical home for me, the companies and orchestras in the UK. So that kind of launched my career.
When I watched the tape about you, the little video about you on your website, you talked about the preparation to do this, the work that you had to put in. You said, I felt like I'd already won because I was here.
Absolutely.
What did you have to do to even get on that stage for that big final performance?
First of all, you had to be nominated to even be in the competition.
So who nominated you?
It's a mystery.
You don't know? Seriously?
I have a pretty good idea, but you're nominated usually by, I mean, if you're in a young artist program, it's usually your boss in the program or your voice teacher. But I don't pry because, you know, I think it's anonymous for a reason, and sometimes people know. But you do have to be nominated to do it. And I think at the time, at least 600 people were nominated, and those are all people that either have the beginning of a career or are in young artist programs. So you're already kind of taken the first couple steps to having a career. And it was just very challenging finding music that fit all of the requirements. Once you get to the semifinals, only 25 of you out of that 600 nominated get to the semifinals. And that, you know, you get something like 15 minutes of music, and they have to be different. Written in different time periods, different languages, different styles of music. And they have to be something you sing better than anything else in your repertoire. So I went through so many different programs to come up with the right one. And I have to say, and I don't know if I should say this, but I will, I didn't think I would get to the finals. So I didn't have really a dress for it. And I also didn't have really repertoire for it. I had sung two out of the three pieces in public. And the middle piece that I sang in that for the finals in front of millions of people, I kick myself for this, really. It was the first time I had sung it in public. So that was because I never thought I would make it to the finals.
Is that the one that we actually saw you sing on your website?
No, it was a Mozart piece, which now Mozart's one of the composers that's regularly in rotation in my repertoire. But at the time, I had never sung really Mozart repertoire. But I knew I needed something of that style. So I said, well, okay, what about this? I'm not going to have to sing it. Of course not. So I had to pull out a cocktail dress and somehow sing that piece in front of millions of people. And by sheer, you know, luck and timing, I won the competition.
What was that moment like when they heard? I know what the look on your face was, but.
Holy cow.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, that's. It's probably like you would think it would be like. Well, I can think it would be like winning Miss America or something. You knew that in that moment, your life would never be the same. And there are very few competitions in the classical music world you can say that about. Maybe three or four. And it's very true. From that moment that they called my name, I've not had a lack of work. It's kind of amazing. And for a lyric soprano, we need that. We need those kinds of things. So it was shocking, even though I had prepared myself for the possibility. It was still shocking. And it was in a dream state for about 2 or 3 days.
So where's your crystal cup now?
Oh, you know, I'm shameless. I have it on a shelf. We got 3 trophies, one for participating, one for winning your round, and one for winning the competition. And they're on my shelf in my entertainment center. But to be fair, I have a small place. So that's the only place I can put them, right? In front of everybody. So, yeah. So I remember having it in... I kind of wrapped it around. It was my teddy bear in bed for about a week after I won.
I bet it was. I bet it was.
Yeah.
Hey, look what I did.
Yeah.
Now, I assume, Ward, that you met Nicole at Lyric in Chicago. So what is it about her that really captured your ear and your eye?
Well, I've always... I remember we were talking about this yesterday. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was a while before we actually met, you know, on a personal, just one to one kind of level. But I heard her a long time before I actually, you know, met her and talked to her from the pit, you know, because I was down there. And you know, the people at the Opera Center in Chicago it's one of the best programs in the country, and they get to do all sorts of repertoire. And there's a concert once a year that features them. It's called the Rising Stars Concert, which is great. And so I had heard Nicole do a lot of repertoire, and I always remember just being captivated by the quality of her voice, because she's got so much color in her voice, and it's a very rich voice, but it's not heavy, which is a really great combination, you know. And I'd heard her sing a little bit in French too, and I mean obviously back then I wasn't thinking about what I was going to program in 2017 as music director of the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. However, you know, I've heard her sing many things since. In fact, I think the last time we saw each other was in London. She was doing A Child of Our Time, which is another piece I love, with the BBC, and I was at that concert, and we saw each other backstage. But I remember being struck at that performance, as I was back in our Chicago days. And then when I was thinking about repertoire for this current season, I love the piece, just like she does, the Scheherazade. And she was the first one who popped into my mind, and I thought, I've been wanting to work with you for so long. This will be the first time we work together. So I couldn't be more pleased. I mean, I remember telling our artistic administrator, I want Nicole Cabell. Aww. And he said, okay, we'll try, you know, and I said, yeah, try. And then I was thinking, she won't come, you know, to work with me here in Rochester. And then when he said, she's good to go, I was like, oh my God, it was great. It was great. So, I'm thrilled.
Pleasure's mine.
Now we wrap up, the program with a very different piece. Mercifully, there's a little time between when Nicole finishes the last notes of Scheherazade and when the first notes of Shostakovich 5 begin. The Shostakovich Symphony No. 5 was written at a time when he was really under the gun. He was essentially a non-person. He'd written an opera and a ballet that they hated, and they essentially made it very clear to him, hit or nothing.
Yeah, it was an amazing time in history. I mean, just to try to put yourself in that world and in Shostakovich's mind, I mean, it's just I've always been fascinated by it, you know, ever since I started to learn more. And, you know, in the last few weeks and months, I've been reading a lot about, just to sort of, you know, get back to that mental space. And it's terrifying, and it's so complicated, and it's really a mystery how anyone could have survived, their soul could have survived. I mean, you know, it's not about physical survival, although, you know, health standards were probably poor then too, but it's more about the soul. And the thing that's so compelling about Shostakovich, and I think why he resonates, of course, with Russians, but also with people all over the world, is his steely ability to still create art and feed his soul in the face of this utter oppression, which was the Stalin regime. I mean, it was just horrible. He began life, Shostakovich, as a musical prodigy, and it's very interesting if you look in books, or you know, it's probably online too, at photographs of him as a young child. He was very happy He was, you know, as I said, a prodigy. He was composing from a very early age, not unlike Mozart. He was kind of like Russian Mozart. He was very popular. And he was even popular with Stalin and with the regime at first because he got into film composing, which is another nice distant connection with Elliot Goldenthal, by the way, on this program. In fact, he wrote, some people have suggested that one of the reasons, in addition to Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, that he was spared from execution or exile was that Stalin actually loved a tune from one of Shostakovich's early film scores, and he sang it to himself, and he had it performed for him, Stalin did, and he loved it, and people thought that he had a little soft spot, if Stalin had any soft spots, for this song and Shostakovich. So, you know, that in combination with this Fifth Symphony, which he said was an artist's response to just criticism, which, of course, was him saying what he needed to say. But to lay out the scene, you know, Shostakovich, as I said, was composing film music, very popular, very successful, and as is a natural inclination for an artist, especially one as talented as Shostakovich, gifted, really, is he started to venture further afield in terms of his harmony and in terms of his orchestrations. And the music he wrote was amazing. And, you know, other musicians now, we think, God, it was so groundbreaking. I mean, it's like what Beethoven did or, you know, Ravel with orchestration. I mean, he was really a trailblazer, but it didn't fly with the regime. And it was Lady Macbeth, his opera, which is just an amazing score, but it deals with all these visceral emotions and some real ugliness. I mean, there's a whole scene where character is raped, and he represents it musically in the orchestra, and it's chilling because it's such vivid music and description of an awful act. And so another ironic thing is that the opera at first was actually well received. People, the public got it, and they were really intrigued and, you know, moved by it. And so it was getting a lot of play, and it was popular. And then Stalin heard about it and said, "Oh, I have to go check this out." So he attended a performance. It was almost 2 years since the opera had been premiered. And so Shostakovich actually heard Stalin was going to be in attendance, and he rushed over to the theater because he thought, "I'm going to receive this praise from Stalin." Well, Stalin left after it wasn't even finished yet, and everyone thought, "Oh no, that's not a good sign." And the next morning in Pravda, the newspaper, the propaganda newspaper that obviously Stalin, some say he even wrote the article himself, but the headline was translated was basically muddle or chaos instead of music. And it went on to just absolutely excoriate Shostakovich. And it was brutal, you know, saying that he had lost his mind, he had no talent, this was filth, this was a terrible piece of music. And so it was pulled from the theater. Shostakovich also had to retract his Fourth Symphony, which had been composed, and the Fourth Symphony didn't emerge again until the 60s, I think. And that's an amazing piece too. But again, he was exploring his musical expression, his language. And one thing about the Fourth Symphony, and one of the reasons that he ended the Fifth Symphony the way he did, was he said to a friend that Fourth Symphony ends in a minor key and it ends softly. And, you know, I need to write something that's going to make them stand up and say, yes, this is, you know, towing the party line, and this is, you know, glory for Stalin. So he ended Shostakovich 5 the way he did.
And it
did. Which we'll talk about in a minute, because that's a fascinating thing, too.
But. And it did. It had a 30-minute ovation on mm-hmm. its premiere. It had great success. Someplace in the middle of the Shostakovich is the Largo. And that one, it is said, left people in the audience outwardly weeping.
It's unbelievable. And actually, if you listen to the whole symphony, well, I mean, it's extremely personal. But one of the things that I think, and one of the reasons why I like the pairing with the Ravel, even though it doesn't seem obvious, is that the subtlety and the quiet intensity, which is so important in the Ravel in a slightly different way, but it's very important, is also the crux of the Fifth Symphony. We think of Shostakovich 5 for the loud, you know, the goose-stepping militaristic, you know, moments in the First Symphony, or the big triumphant, really over the top, almost obscenely over the top, which was the intent finale. But what it's really about is that the opening and how vigor is quickly squashed, and you're left with just a very mundane heartbreak and you know, oppression. And then the third movement, if Shostakovich had ended the symphony with the third movement, he probably would have been executed or exiled, because the people got it. It was a lament. It's a nightmare, really, which is what the people at the time were living. I mean, and at the same time, it's also, you know, I'll never forget. And I actually told the orchestra this story in our first rehearsal. I'll never forget the first time I ever conducted this piece, Shostakovich 5. It was in Moscow in, I think, 2005, and it was with a Russian orchestra. And, you know, I was asking them all sorts of questions, and we were doing the rehearsal in the Mosfilm studio, which is still there. And, you know, I was asking, you know, what's this third movement about to you? What is it? Is it this? Is it that? And I had all these, you know, great ideas or, you know, complex theories about it. And someone said to me, no, it's simpler than that. He said, it's a prayer. That's what this third movement is. He said, it's a prayer for all those who didn't come home one morning or disappeared in the evening into those black cars and nobody knows where they went. It's a prayer for all those who were sent out to in the gulags or out to Siberia. It's a prayer for all of our souls, which we nearly lost. And so there's a great connection which resonated with the people at the time with, you know, Russian Orthodox liturgy and the great choral tradition. So you have to think of this beautiful Russian choir singing a very soft hymn, because, you know, if they sang it too loud, Stalin, the government would have come, and that would have been it. But this wonderful and just poignant expression, this prayer in the beginning, gives way gradually to anxiety, because, you know, you can't take time to express these feelings, or else you could get in trouble. And so there's all this back and forth, and then it builds to this extraordinary climax, which I think is the outward expression of this nightmare. And it's truly horrifying. I mean, it's just it makes all the hair on the back of my neck stand up even now as I talk about it, thinking about it. And once we reach this tremendous climax in the middle of it, we're propelled forward from this paralyzing horror to the anguish and the anger, and you hear this visceral frustration that everyone was feeling, and it's like a crying out. They have to just purge themselves of all this repressed emotion and all this terrible, oppression and this terrible weight that was on all the people at the time. And then after all that ends, we drift back into the prayer state. And so it's this tremendous arc in the third movement. It's every bit as powerful today as it was back then. And for anyone who lived in those times, I think it's extremely personal. And it was for Shostakovich as well. So what does he do then for the fourth movement? You know, he's got to finish with a bang, because otherwise, you know, he was really on thin ice.
So the final movement, if people talk about this, there are a couple of approaches. And you know what I'm about to talk about. The slow and the fast. And I've actually seen this performed both times.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do you choose?
Well, you have to come find out. No, it's a very interesting story, actually, about all the tempi in this symphony, because Shostakovich, you know, he was always, by all accounts, people who met him, very quiet. And it's a fascinating story if you read about the premiere and the rehearsal process for the first ever performance of the Fifth Symphony, because Mravinsky, who conducted that very first performance and conducted it throughout his own life, and it's fascinating, by the way, to listen how his interpretation changed throughout. He said, I read this somewhere recently, he told the story of the rehearsals, and Shostakovich put no metronome markings or tempo indications in the score. There's nothing there. And, you know, Mravinsky was very conscientious, and he was frustrated because he was trying to prepare this, and he kept asking Shostakovich, what should it be, and he wouldn't say anything. And then he would play through, he would guess, and Shostakovich would just sit there and nod and say, oh, it's wonderful, it's fine, it's great. But he knew that Shostakovich was just maybe afraid to say something or just didn't want to, you know, touch it. And so what Mravinsky finally started doing, it's a very creative solution to this problem, actually. He deliberately took tempos that he knew were way off and would keep going until Shostakovich finally got angry and would come up to the podium and say, no, it has to be like this. And that's how he says he got the tempos for that first performance. And when you know that, then the rest of the bizarre history makes a little bit more sense, because there were four or five editions published between then and now. It's probably more, actually, but there are four or five main ones that people study and use for editions. And the tempo markings are wildly different, and the end is the best example, because there's a version where the quarter note equals 184, and then there's one where the eighth note equals 184. That's literally twice as fast or twice as slow. So what are you supposed to do, right? And Mravinsky tended toward the slower version, and so did Rostropovich, and a lot of great Russian conductors have said it needs to be this slower tempo, because it's Shostakovich's inside joke against Stalin. I mean, it's not, to call it an inside joke is not, doesn't give it the gravitas it deserves, but it really is one of those hidden messages, I guess is a better way to describe it, where he's giving them what they've asked for. He's giving Stalin and the government this triumphant ending, but it's a very hollow, empty triumph, because throughout the symphony, starting in the first movement, you'll hear a great use of repetition in rhythmic figures. In the first movement, there's a section after the big, awful march of the Soviet, you know, troops come in to sort of lay down the law and oppress the people. You hear this, the xylophone joins the strings and the woodwinds with this repeater, and it goes on for just a little bit too long, so it's oppressive. And the repetition of themes throughout, or of rhythmical figures throughout each movement, is a common thread. And so when we get to the end and we're supposed to have this big, glorious fanfare, the strings go up to an A, and they just keep repeating da 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 da, literally for like minutes. And string players, you know, it's uncomfortable if you do it more than once in rehearsal, because it's very taxing. But it's that oppression. And the other thing is, he doesn't give us an outright major chords. Like he throws in a B flat where it should be a B natural, which gives it that dark oppressive color at the very end. So educated people, musically educated people, I think, were aware of this when it was happening. He gave Stalin his fanfare, but he colored it in such a way that people who knew what was really going on appreciated the sleight of hand. And of course, all the government people who were there, and the censors and whoever, they didn't get it. He got it over them. And the reaction from the crowd, you know, was so thunderous, because I think most of them got the symphony as it was intended to be received. And the government thought, this is a glorification of Stalin at the end. Listen to how loud and vibrant and robust this is with the brass and everything. So, yes, Comrade Shostakovich has finally given us our due. And so it was really a win-win for both.
That Tolstoy said that the finale brought victory and an enormous optimistic lift. Which,
yes,
I assume you think might have been tongue-in-cheek when he said it?
Well, there's a lot of double entendre there. I mean, there's multiple meanings in that statement. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about how you feel at the end of a various piece. And, you know, when I get to the end of a Mahler symphony, for example, and Shostakovich was a great admirer of Mahler, by the way, and you hear Mahlerian elements throughout the symphony as well. And the end is Mahlerian in a lot of ways, in its scale, in its orchestration. But at the end of a Mahler symphony, you get this sort of finality to this epic journey, and sort of, I always, you know, except for the tragic, you know, symphonies, the uplifting ones, you feel this great joy and this great satisfaction, and you feel you're very up when you finish one of those symphonies. But when I get to the end of Shostakovich 5, I'm not happy, and I shouldn't be happy. You know, he leaves it somewhat unresolved, because that fanfare, as glorious and robust and full and vibrant as it is to hear, because it's a wonderful, you know, orchestration, it's hollow. And I think that is, I mean, it's so difficult to achieve that, and the way Shostakovich was able to do it, I think, is just absolutely masterful, and it's why it's timeless, the symphony.
So you think that this was an extraordinary act of subversion?
Oh, I mean, the courage and the resolve that Shostakovich had to be, you know, smacked down like that and pushed down and almost, I mean, the non-person. It was not the first time in his life either that he was declared a non-person, which is, you know, what's more demeaning and insulting than that? Saying you're not even a person? I mean, it's unbelievable to imagine that. But the fact that he had the inner strength to say, okay, I can get through this. And I think in the first movement, you hear a lot of that struggle. Okay, you hear the disappointment, you hear the oppression, you hear almost giving up. And then there's always this little ember that turns into a, it starts to smolder, and then you can feel the defiance sort of start to well up again, and then it gets squashed. And the first movement is extraordinary in that way, because it's all this back and forth, and it's Shostakovich sort of working through this. And then the second movement is kind of a release, because it's the second movement is the fun movement, even though it's still heavy, and it's not elegant, but it's a fun waltz, and it's kind of a party. But we're prepared for the end in the first movement. And then the third movement is just, I mean, it can stand on its own. It's just an unbelievable work.
This is the question that I ask whenever something, when this comes up. And that's, why did he stay? Why didn't he leave? They certainly couldn't kill him. He was way too famous.
Mm.
Well, they might.
Well, yeah, you say that now, but I don't think Stalin was afraid of that just because someone was famous, unfortunately. But that's a great question, and I don't know the answer. He was a very, very complicated person. I mean, he was sent around the world as a representative of Russia, a cultural, you know, ambassador of sorts, and he certainly would have had many opportunities to defect if he wanted to, and I'm sure many places would have received him with open arms, but he always went back. Maybe he just identified too much with the struggle that the Russians were going through, and he felt, and I'm completely speculating here, but maybe he felt that his voice was an important one that people needed. I mean, if you think about the experience that the people who heard that symphony in that moment in 1930, mid-30s, 37, you know, must have had. Shostakovich, I'd like to think, picked up on that. And maybe he thought, you know, I can't abandon my countrymen. I can't abandon my people. I have to help them resist and help them find joy and find meaning in this ugly world.
So you bracketed your evening with the Golden Thaw and the Shostakovich. Does the character in the Golden Thaw resist?
The Golden Thaw is not. The Golden Thaw is more, I think, an expression of maybe a little bit of aggression, and there's a good juxtaposition. I mean, it's just a warm up for the Shostakovich. The Golden Thaw is not meant, I don't think, to be quite as profound an experience. I mean, it's only 6 minutes long. But what the Golden Thaw does prepare us for is, you know, the very angular, very harsh sort of oppressive hints of oppression do appear in the Golden Thaw. And, you know, and fun also, which is the second movement of the Shostakovich. So, and it's got a little bit of lyricism, and it's got some of that dark, you know, heartfelt, almost a little bit sorrowful melody in it. So it's just a little tiny taste of some of the things you'll hear later in the Shostakovich.
Almost like Nicole Azee, if I were in the Orient, this is what it would
mm-hmm.
be.
Exactly.
If I were in Stalin's Russia, this might be what I felt.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to thank you both very much for coming in and talking to me about this really fascinating concert, which is coming up. RPO Music Director Awards, Darren Soprano, Nicole Cabell. If you like information about the RPO season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.